It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out how Eau Claire is changing due in part to the city's booming music scene.
First, we're following up on a story we've been covering for the last few months, the scandal at the Toma VA Hospital. A new report from the Department of Veterans Affairs Office of the Inspector General blames the death of a Marine veteran on the care of the Toma Center. This is the latest news about the larger allegations of overprescription and mismanagement at the Toma VA.
Heath Drusen joins us now. He's a reporter for Stars and Stripes, an independent newspaper that covers issues important to the military community in the United States. Heath, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So, as we mentioned, there's this new report from the Inspector General on this death of a Marine veteran in a VA facility there. What are we hearing from the Inspector General in this new report?
So, what the Inspector General is saying is that this death was the fault, actually, of the hospital. And what they're saying is that there's a few issues that the drugs that he was prescribed were a potentially fatal mix, and on top of that, that the staff of the hospital didn't properly inform him of the potential risks of the drugs. Further, when they found him unresponsive. The really damning thing in there is that the resuscitation efforts were chaotic and that they didn't actually have the proper drugs on hand to help reverse the effects of the overdose that ultimately killed him.
And does this Inspector General's report recommend a course of action, a change in procedures in Toma?
It has recommendations. They're not very specific, but they do say that the regional director should review what happened to determine if administrative action should be taken. So essentially, they're saying the regional director should take a look at this and see if anyone should be disciplined, possibly fired. But it's not very specific. The other thing that they recommend is to look at their emergency procedures. Their resuscitation procedures, they say they need to take a look at that and make sure that they're in compliance with the VA standards for that.
Now, this comes against a backdrop of a lot of accusations at the Toma VA, allegations of overprescribing a particular of opiate medications. Does this new report address that background?
So the report doesn't. I did speak to the IG. I spoke to the IG's office about that because they actually had an earlier report about the Toma VA, and the IG took a lot of heat for that because they actually closed it without publicizing it. It eventually came out in the open, and they had essentially found, they said they found no evidence that there was a problem with opiate prescription. Now, when I asked them if this changed anything, this latest report, they said that they should be looked at separately and that they stood by their earlier report that there were not problems, or at least not systematic problems, with opiate prescriptions at the Toma VA. Now, that's obviously something that that a lot of people disagree with, and certainly some lawmakers have been very critical about.
And you've reported that there are a lot of critics of the VA who have focused their attention on the Inspector General's office itself, saying, in effect, it's there to cover up trouble, punish whistleblowers. What kind of things are you hearing from critics of the IG's office?
The critics of the IG's office, and this goes right up to some pretty prominent lawmakers, they say there's not enough independence. And that the VA has too much say into how the IG operates, and that some of the reports they do, even if they do find something critical, they don't always see the light of day. Now, they haven't had a permanent inspector general in a year and a half, and that's something a lot of critics think is part of the problem. And their acting inspector general, he resigned under pressure in June, and part of that was the accusation that he was not being hard enough on the VA. So they continue without a permanent inspector general, and we'll see if there are going to be some changes with somebody new in charge.
We're talking with Heath Druzan, reporter for Stars and Stripes, about a new report on a death at the VA facility in Tomah. Now, looking nationally here, obviously the VA has gotten a lot of criticism. A lot of that is centered around waiting times at facilities around the country. Are you seeing anything like what's going on at Tomah with these opiate drug issues in other facilities around the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, this is not only a problem across the VA system, but it's really a problem across hospitals in America. I mean, the treatment of pain in the U.S. This is kind of brought into sharp focus that there's a lot of over-prescription of drugs. I've written a bit about that. There's a couple innovative programs that at local VAs that are trying to get people off drugs and do more actual treatment of the pain instead of just numbing it. So you've got things like acupuncture and pool therapy, the problem is getting the bureaucracy to shift its gears and make some of these programs, which have been quite successful, to be a nationwide effort.
Staying on the national level, you also reported on a new proposal from Senator John McCain allowing veterans to seek help more than they currently can from outside the VA system. What would he change, and what's the reaction been from veterans groups?
Well, the details of the proposal, what he's really thinking, that's still a bit of a mystery because he dropped that bill very quietly right before Congress left for a month-long recess. But it's certainly going to be controversial because it gives veterans more choice in where they can go as far as it allows them to have medical visits outside of the VA paid for, even if they don't meet the current standards, which is they're too far away to get treatment or they can't find the treatment they need in a VA center. The flip side of that is, as some people see that as a big step towards privatizing the VA, and a lot of veterans groups have opposed steps like that in the past.
Now, bringing things back to Tomah, we've got this new report from the Inspector General. Is there a sense that that's all we're going to hear from that office now, or will there be more investigations underway?
As far as the Inspector General, I would expect that this report is final as far as this specific issue, because this was an investigation into a single death as opposed to the earlier report, which was an investigation into whether or not there were systemic problems. So I certainly don't think it's the last you're going to hear about it. I imagine that there's going to be more from the family of this veteran, as well as the Wisconsin senators who pushed so hard to have this investigation done. But as far as any follow-up for this specific death, I think probably not. Not from the IG, at least.
Heath, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem.
That was Heath Druzan, reporter for Stars and Stripes, an independent newspaper that covers issues important to the military community in the U.S. He was with us to talk about a new report from the VA's Office of the Inspector General, blaming the Tomah VA and the care provided there for the death of a Marine veteran.
I am my mother's only one. It's
That's the music of Eau Claire's Justin Vernon with the band Bon Iver. With the first ever Eau Claire Music Festival just barely in the rearview mirror, we're taking a look at how the booming music scene there has spurred transformation in the city from the economy to the climate for local musicians. Tom Giffey and Eric Christensen join us now. They're co-managing editors at Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire. Tom, Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having us. This is great.
Yeah, good to be here.
And Tom, we'll start with you. Did you ever think that you'd see a music festival as big and as star-studded as you just did in Eau Claire?
That's an interesting question, because we actually have five major music festivals in Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. The Eau Claire Festival, of course, which, as you said, was just a few weeks ago, got an awful lot of attention, partly because it was headed by kind of our homegrown star. He got a lot of his friends from across the music spectrum to come. And a lot of bands performed that were headed by current and former Eau Clairians. But it kind of brought a lot of attention because it was part of the indie scene, part of some, you know, led by a man who won a couple of Grammys a few years ago. But we have for a long time been a center of music, and people haven't necessarily noticed us as such until comparatively recently. So I think people that actually lived around here have known about this, and maybe now the wider world is beginning to take note.
And Eric, that was just the one festival. You have five, but in general, what have you noticed over the past few years about the city's music and art scene?
It's for sure growing. I mean, it's always been kind of our own little thing here between musicians and the venues and everybody that supports the local art scene here. That's always been sort of it. It's always kind of been in that Chippewa Valley bubble. But I think more and more you're seeing a lot of not only artists, but now you have this festival. It's breaking out of just that Eau Claire bubble, and it's becoming more of a national name. I think when people hear the term Eau Claire, they kind of associate it with music now, and that's kind of the trend where we've been seeing it go. And I think it's going to go even farther than that. We're kind of right at the beginning of it.
Yeah, and that is definitely new. I think people mm-hmm. wouldn't have necessarily associated. They might have associated Eau Claire with tires or with Hank Aaron playing here in the 1950s mm-hmm. and things that were kind of long past. But the music in the past few years has really begun to put us on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You said there has been this music scene for a while. It's been in the Eau Claire bubble. But is it fair to put down the changes of the past few years to Justin Vernon with that breakout album for Emma forever ago that did get him all that national attention?
Well, you can't ignore that for sure. That's a big, big part of it. I think that was 10 years ago now almost that album came out. And ever since, you know, people have been almost even coming to Eau Claire just to have the experience of being here. And they know sort of what it's like based on that music by itself. But I think once you dig a little deeper in the scene here, you find that it's very diverse. And it's like there's a lot of different musical styles happening. And a lot of people here are very, very good at it. And they make really awesome stuff. You can't not give credit to Justin Vernon to some extent. Because he's done amazing things for this town, especially with this festival now.
Right. But I think he'd be the first to say that he is one among many and grew out of, you know, an excellent educational system, an excellent, you know, there's an amazing jazz program in the university here that has had mm-hmm. a jazz festival for going on, I think, almost 50 years. So there's all these roots that have been here, the foundation that has been laid. And things are finally kind of growing beyond this region. It was amazing to be at that festival and to rub shoulders and to chat with people who had literally come from around the globe mm-hmm. for that festival. They had come to Little Eau Claire, Wisconsin, whereas, you know, the music festivals we've had for years have been more mainstream country and rock festivals where you certainly get tens of thousands of people to come, but they tend to be more Midwesterners. And this kind of vaulted us, to a little bit higher profile as far as where the people are coming from and who is actually looking at our community and our state.
Now, is it just music that's booming, or is it the arts in general? Writing and poetry and other kinds of art, fine arts as well.
We would like to think it's booming. I think, mm-hmm. Again, you've always had those people in the community, but you've had a few successes in that realm. Michael Perry, for example, who was the official quote-unquote narrator of the festival, has had enormous success. You can hear him on public radio, of course. He has kind of shepherded in new writers who have seen his success and realized that they can succeed. We have great visual artists in the community. And I think the more attention you give to one person, I think part of our Midwestern work ethic is we tend to be a little bit, yes, we work hard, but we're also fairly humble about it. So one thing I've noticed among the artistic folks in this area is that they tend to be very willing and even eager to share the spotlight with their friends, and I think that certainly kind of over time helps build up a scene.
And Eric, does that mean there's a lot of cross-pollination going on, that writers are working with musicians and musicians are working with fine artists, and there's just a lot of crossover going on?
Well, that's always been a big part of it. I mean, collaboration, especially around here, is huge. I mean, it's not only musicians that are working together. There's friends that are other artists as well. I mean, there's collaboration with visual artists. You have this writing community that is a big part of it, and they're always quick to collaborate with whoever's around, whoever's doing cool things. People here want to create, and they're always looking for new friends to do that with.
We're talking right now with Tom Giffey and Eric Christensen. They're co-managing editors of Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire. They're talking about the booming art scene and music scene in Eau Claire and how it's affecting the city. Now let's talk a little bit about the economy. You just had this big music festival. People came from around the globe. What's happening with the local businesses?
Well, the number that has been crunched by the local visitors bureau is that among those five major festivals, they were expecting $36 million in economic impact. Obviously, it's very easy to be, or at least used to be easy to be dismissive of the arts. Oh, sure, you know, you have a few people going to a show in a little club or a bar, that's fine. You know, you have an artist who's making some pocket change, but this is real money. This is a significant portion of the tourist economy, and that's just those five festivals. That's not counting any of the music series that happened in the summer, the jazz shows, the fine art shows going beyond music. So it is a huge part of the economy, and also we have a movement to build a new fine performing arts center in the downtown, which is called the Confluence Center, which is a collaboration between community arts groups and the city and the university. And that is rolling along, and hopefully they'll break ground for that next year. And again, Eau Claire has been very innovative in that regard. And I think people across the spectrum here have kind of woken up to the idea of arts as economic impact, which is something we at Volume 1 have talked about for a long time.
And it's getting to the point where, I mean, it's enough money flowing into the area that you can't ignore it anymore. I mean, there's every summer there's going to be that number, and there's going to be people visiting to come to these amazing festivals. I mean, that's even only a percentage of it. I mean, people here are starting now to realize what it takes to invest in a music scene, and it's happening, and it's exciting.
And are you seeing telltale signs of that economy perking up? Are you seeing new restaurants and stores and all of that, the kind of thing that goes along with supporting an industry like that?
I think you do. I mean, it's always a struggle. Those kinds of businesses are quick to flourish and quick to fail, especially, you know, you look at restaurants and service industry jobs. But especially with the Confluence Project in downtown Eau Claire, you are seeing a lot of anticipation for that. You're seeing hotels being renovated there that have been closed in anticipation of that happening. And I think we have seen those green shoots, and we're going to see a lot more in the next couple of years up here.
And there's even some support, like music-related businesses that have popped up in the last 10 years or so, Revival Records being one. They've outgrown two locations now. They keep growing. People keep supporting them. There's places like that. There's places like Ambient Inks, which is a screen printing service that has a lot of big music clients. They just moved into a new space on Water Street here in town. And so you're starting to see kind of the seeds of that start to be laid a little bit, which is it's always exciting.
Now, Justin Vernon, you know, is from the area. He's a big Eau Claire booster. I've heard that he's very committed to the area and to staying there, at least based part of the time. But if he were to change his mind and leave, would he take the local scene with him that's flourishing now? Or do you think it's gotten to be bigger than one band and one guy?
I think for sure, yeah. I think it's definitely more than just Justin Vernon. I think if he left, I don't think you'd see things change that much here on a local level. Obviously, we hope he doesn't. we're glad to have him around. He does amazing things for the community, and we're always, you know, excited to cover stuff like that. And but here, I think people have this spirit of creation. They want to start artistic projects just because it's something that they love to do, and I don't think that's ever going to change. People always say that there must be something in the water or something in that Chippewa River that rolls by in Eau Claire. And maybe that's the case or maybe not, but there is a mindset here that people want to create, and they want to make art, and they want to do it within their own community.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
Thank you for having us. This is great.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Tom Giffey and Eric Christensen. They are of Volume 1 magazine, both co-managing editors there in Eau Claire. And they joined us to talk about the booming art scene and music scene and how it's affecting the city of Eau Claire. And we're going to go out to the news with Wisconsin band Errol Flynn.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Last week, video streaming and rental company Netflix announced a new parental leave policy. Many employees can take as much paid time off as they want during the year after their child is born or adopted. The policy applies to both men and women.
But our next guest says this is not a game changer. She says the policy doesn't matter if the work culture doesn't change along with it. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea, all the parental leave you want for a year after the kid arrives? Is this a good idea? How much time did you take when your child was born or adopted? What kind of parental leave policy is in place where you work? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joan C. Williams joins us now. She's a distinguished professor at the UC Hastings College of the Law and the director of the Center for Work-Life Law. Joan, welcome back to Central Time.
Delighted to be here.
Joan, what was your reaction when you first heard of this new parental leave policy coming out of Netflix?
Well, it was first reported as that it was a year's leave for dads as well as moms, and that is a great policy there. That parental leave longer than a year actually is not desirable because at that point it's typically taken only by moms and it tends to reinforce traditional gender roles and push women out of good jobs. But parental leave for a year is pretty much the perfect amount of leave. So that's fantastic news. Since then, it's been reported that this is not actually, appears to be, not a year's leave, but unlimited leave during the first year. And that is a little bit more concerning because of the way we define the ideal worker in tech, which is basically somebody who is so committed to the job that they're always available for work. So I think that sends a bit of a ambiguous message to professionals at Netflix.
And so just to clarify, when they talk about up to a year, does that mean someone could choose to take a month or they could choose to take that entire year, anywhere in between?
Well, you know, your guess is as good as mine, but unlimited leave up to a year sends, to me, a very different message than a year's parental leave.
So what do you think would stand in the way of people using that leave?
Well, there are studies that show that men who take parental leave often suffer what we call the flexibility stigma. They tend to be seen as stigmatized precisely because they're seen as more feminine than other men. So any leave policy that attempts to encourage professionals in high hours environments to actually use the leave that is available has to very self-consciously counter the flexibility stigma. And I don't know, maybe Netflix is going to do that, but we haven't really got much information about how they're going to implement this new policy.
So if there is this, sounds like, knee-jerk reaction to stigmatize men in particular who might want to use, say, that entire year of optional leave, what would counterbalance that?
Well, I think it's not actually that hard to counterbalance it, and that organizations should be counterbalancing the flexibility stigma for men because, quite frankly, it presents legal risks if you don't counterbalance it. The way you do it is when a man announces that his partner is pregnant. You have a meeting. The supervisor has a meeting, congratulates the man, says, "We think this is great news. Congratulations." We here at the company feel that it's very important for men as well as women to take parental leave, and while it's your choice, I certainly encourage you to take the full amount of leave that you're entitled to. So that's the first meeting. And then this is actually true for men as well as women. Anybody who is taking leave should have a specific, there should be a specific protocol followed while they're going off on leave, while they're ramping down, and then a specific protocol followed while they're coming back from leave, while they're ramping up. And the ramping down protocol, so that's the first meeting. The second meeting is a number of months before, in which case they should be talking about how they're going to transition their work to other members of the team. And then shortly before they go out on leave, just to check in that all of their work has been successfully transitioned. So that's the best practice for designing parental leave in terms of how people should ramp off. And then you have to also be very proactive in managing how they ramp back on. We hear again and again reports that women, when they return from maternity leave, have too little work to do because sometimes it's benevolently meant of like, well, I have this great assignment, but I know it's not a great time for you. Other times it's a little bit less benevolent. It's like, well, I don't want to give, you know, I can't depend on her anymore, so I don't want to give her work. The second, again, represents a legal risk for companies because that's really retaliation for taking family medical leave. So companies should be very actively managing parental leave, and let's just hope that Netflix is going to do exactly that.
We're talking right now with Joan C. Williams for the Center for Work-Life Law about the new unlimited parental leave up to a year at Netflix, this policy announced last week. And Joan, you're finding some things that are not quite ideal, but on the other hand, is it sort of bold and audacious for a company to be doing something like this?
It is bold and audacious, and as I believe I said at the start, and if I didn't, let me say it again, you know, hats off to Netflix for announcing that its professionals can take basically what policymakers have found is pretty much the perfect amount of leave, which is a year.
What about the culture that goes on at Netflix? I don't work there, but I understand that companies like this, there's often an expectation of a lot of hours worked and a lot of time put in and dedication being measured according to a certain number of metrics there that employees may try to meet. With leave, is there the danger there that employees will still try to adhere to the prevailing workplace culture instead of taking advantage maybe of this leave?
Well, you know, I don't know much about the Netflix culture either. So I think at that point we're both kind of speculating. I can talk more generally about the culture in high-tech companies out here in the Bay Area, since I'm in San Francisco. And you've described it pretty well, which is they really define the ideal worker as someone who's so committed to the job that they're virtually always available to work long hours. And that's exactly the kind of thing that makes it difficult to effectively implement a parental leave policy. And that's, I think, the source of some of the concern.
Let's talk a little bit about why parental leave is important. We know what science says about why it's important for parents to be home with that child during the first year of the child's life.
Parental leave is very important, first of all, for moms. I mean, moms who have cesarean sections have to recover from major abdominal surgery, quite apart from everything else. And in addition, moms who are nursing are typically very often in the beginning nursing every 2 hours, so they're extremely sleep deprived. And so just for mother's physical recovery, it's very important to have an adequate amount of maternity leave. In addition, studies show that it's very important for fathers to have leave and to take it, and that fathers who take parental leave typically change their relationship with their children forever. They have a closer relationship with their children forever. So I can't stress, I think many Americans just assume, oh, yeah, of course it's important for mom to take parental leave, and they're right. It is really important for mom to take parental leave, but it's equally important for dads to take parental leave. And there, I'm not talking about 2 days or 2 weeks. I'm talking about the leaves of the length that mothers typically take.
And it may be worth pointing out here that it sounds as though this benefit of unlimited parental leave up to a year applies only to salary employees, not to hourly employees. What do you think about that distinction?
Well, I mean, it does not apply. The Netflix leave policy that we've just been discussing does not apply to its hourly workers. And obviously, you know, having a baby if you're an hourly worker is no less easy than having a baby if you're a professional. And it may be harder because you don't have the wherewithal often to hire as much help. That said, the countries that have robust parental leave, all of them fund it at these major industrialized countries at a countrywide level. And the reason that makes sense is because what you're really talking about is whether you're going to have the next generation of citizens. And it makes sense that since everybody's going to benefit from the next generation of citizens, after all, who will take care of you when you're elderly and need a doctor? It will be one of these babies. That's why European countries pretty much universally, and other major industrialized countries pretty much universally, have parental leave financed at a national level. We don't. And if you have parental leave that's our only parental leave that's mandated is 3 months of unpaid leave under the Family Medical Leave Act, which covers, by most estimates, only a bit more than half of the workforce. If you have paid leave provided at the enterprise level, companies are going to have the incentive to do exactly what Netflix is doing, which is to provide the leave only to high human capital workers who the company has the most invested in retaining. But in many ways, I don't fault Netflix here so much as I fault the country for not adequately investing in the next generation of citizens.
We're talking right now to Joan C. Williams from the Center for Work-Life Law about the new unlimited parental leave policy up to a year at Netflix announced last week.
And we want to hear from you. What are things like where you work as an employer, as an employee? What kind of parental leave policy do you have there? How much time do you think you should have? How much time should parents be able to take off of work? And why? What do you think of this idea that we're hearing from Netflix? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now about parental leave policies with Joan C. Williams, director of the Center for Work-Life Law at University of California, Hastings.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do parents need more time off paid or unpaid, when they have a new kid in the house. How does it work where you are? Do you think there's enough parental leave at your workplace, whether you're the boss or the employee? How much time did you take off when you became a new parent? How much difference do you think it made for you, for your kid? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Joe, not all companies might have the economic flexibility, the budgetary flexibility to do a policy like Netflix is proposing they're going to do. But do you think they could also be a pace setter, that people will look at them and say, I want to attract employees and get a good reputation for my company in terms of supportive family policies, so I'm going to follow suit? Do you think people will fall in line?
I would love to say yes, but I don't. I think I have to say no. I think this may be, certainly it may be a pace setter in high tech in the Bay Area. The market is red hot here. People are really chasing the talent very, very hard. And a number of other tech companies, in fact, have announced parental leave policies in the last few days. And so it is, I think, really heartening that in that kind of context where people are chasing the hot talent, that what they turn to, or one of the things they turn to, is longer parental leave. So I think that's a tremendous step forward. But do I think this will spread throughout the economy? I have to say I don't.
Let's go to a caller now. We have Jody on the line in Fond du Lac. Hi, Jody.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say, about 3 years ago, I'm a teacher, and about 3 years ago, my husband and I had a child, and we've been trying to have a child for quite some time, so when it actually happened, we were kind of not necessarily financially prepared for it, and had I been a little more prepared, it might have turned out differently, but what ended up happening is that I just could not, like, physically bring myself to leave my child in daycare for 10 hours plus a day. So I decided kind of last minute to leave my job as a teacher, and it was really kind of a devastating feeling. And I always felt like, gosh, there's got to be some way that, you know, mothers and fathers can, you know, spend time with their child and raise them at least for the first year of their life. And so I'm really excited about this. I'm done having children, but just kind of curious if your guest thinks that this is kind of a trendy thing, or if this is going to catch on, because I really felt like this was something that needed to happen or needs to happen for families.
Jody, thanks a lot for the call. And Jody felt like she had to choose between her job or her child. Do you think that's something that resonates with a lot of parents?
I think what Jody's call signals is that we are losing out in the economy, where a lot of women who want to continue to be employed after they have children are leaving their jobs because 3 months maternity, it feels like 3 hours of maternity leave, but in fact it's 3 months of maternity leave, which is sort of the standard maternity leave in the United States, is just too short. At 3 months, the mother is sometimes still recovering from the birth. She's still exhausted. The child is extremely young. The child is still often nursing a lot. 3 months is just too short a maternity leave. And why should we care as a nation? I mean, I think we want to keep women like Jody in the workforce. There was just an article in the paper today talking about the dearth of certified teachers. It does not make sense to be chasing certified teachers out of their jobs by offering too short of a maternity leave. And the studies show that that's what happens if the maternity leaves are too short.
Can you do a little compare and contrast for us? How does the U.S. look compared with the rest of the developed world when it comes to leave policies like this?
Night and day, and we're the night. That's how we look. The Europeans who come to the United States, just frankly, and I often talk to them, they just think that the situation in this country is quite simply bizarre beyond belief in their view. They cannot believe that we have such poor benefits for people who are raising the next generation of citizens. They can't believe that our
parental leave isn't paid. They can't believe that it's only 3 months. One thing I would also suggest to Jody is that I don't know if you're unionized, but I guess this is maybe in Wisconsin a highly freighted topic, but one of the things that gives teachers better maternity leaves is in some unions, they've bargained for something called a gradual return to work, where people don't have to suddenly go off maternity leave and back to full-time work, because Jody mentioned 10 hours a day, and my brother's a teacher, and I've read the studies, and that's actually how long a typical teacher's day is 10 hours a day. That's a very long day for someone who's just returned from maternity leave, especially after 3 months. So this gradual return to work policy, which exists in contracts of the Communication Workers of America and in some other unions, is something that unionized teachers should really take a look at.
Well, Joan, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about this today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We've been talking with Joan C. Williams. She's the professor at the University of California Hastings College of the Law and the director of the Center for Work-Life Law. She was with us to talk about the new parental leave policy at Netflix, extending unlimited leave time for new parents up to 1 year.
You can hear more coverage of this new parental leave policy, what it means society-wide, on the Joy Cardine Show Wednesday morning at 6. It is peak camping season now, which means it's also peak s'mores season. And point of fact, today is also National S'mores Day for some reason.
S'mores are those tasty little camping sandwiches. Usually you got a toasty marshmallow, a little square of chocolate, and you put it between two squares of graham crackers. Kind of a staple of the campfire camping experience.
It's pretty much my favorite. I'm not a big camper. That's my favorite part of the camping experience, pretty much. There's a little controversy, though, that we've stumbled onto here. For example, you say s'mores.
I say s'mores, the correct pronunciation.
I say s'mores, like you want to eat some more, s'mores. And we want to hear how you say it, by the way. Let us know over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And while you're at it, which do you prefer? Do you go for the purest version, the Hershey's chocolate square, the milk chocolate? I just discovered dark chocolate on this by accident, and I haven't been the hugest s'mores fan, but now that I try them with dark chocolate, I kind of get it. I get why all of you people are so crazy about s'mores.
Yeah, let us know how you eat your s'mores also on the Central Time Facebook page. My curse is, so since I don't like camping and I love s'mores, I try to recreate it at home. But like microwave, no. The Marshalls get weird and puffy. Toaster oven, no, not quite right. Over the stovetop, like whatever you use, a
like
fork
a gas
or something.
Burner maybe?
Yeah, yeah. But then whatever, it's hard to clean sticky marshmallow off of stuff. So I don't know. I have not really replicated the experience in my kitchen.
You need more campfires in your home.
I see some downside somewhere in there. Well, anyway, let us know your s'mores thoughts on Facebook. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.